All right, we are in the book of Numbers, chapters 21 to 24 is in our study tonight. And we're going to take a look, first of all, at our outline. This is one of the outlines that we're following. We're beginning a new section. As Baxter outlines the book, we have the old generation, then we had the transition era, and now we're in the new generation, meaning there's the new journeying, the new numbering, and the new instruction. We'll get to all of that here in just a moment, but we're beginning this new section. They're making their way closer to the promised land, to crossing over into the promised land. As per Wiersbe's outline, he's at the new generation, same thing. He just left out the that middle section of the outline that we saw just a moment ago. Let's review our chapters, or at least most of those, and then we'll get underway with chapter 21. Chapter 1 was the census, first census. The second one is coming up a little bit later. Chapter 2, separation by camps. Chapter 3, Levites chosen and numbered. And then chapter 4 is their duties. Chapter 5, test for an unfaithful wife as well as unclean persons. Chapter 6, Nazarite vow. We want to remember that because we'll come to that again and again and again throughout some things in the Old Testament. By that I simply mean there'll be times that we'll say this perhaps is the Nazarite vow. We might not always know. Chapter 7, offering of the leaders. Chapter 8, dedication of the Levites. Good. Chapter 9. This is where this is not the first time we've seen this, but the fire and the cloud is going to guide them and will from this point on. Chapter 10 had to do with the silver trumpets and their departure from Sinai. So they're leaving Sinai at that point. So that brings us to chapter 11. What happens in 11? People complain. We see this over and over again. Chapter 12 dealt with Miriam and Aaron complaining. Chapter 13. The spies sent out. That's a notable chapter. Not that any chapter is not notable, but that one is one, it's memorable because of sending the spies into the land and the negative report. Chapter 14. They're punished to wandering for how many years? 40 years. So some time has already passed, 38 and a half years left in their sentence. Chapter 15. Laws about sacrifice, and the Sabbath. Chapter 16 is a notable chapter because it deals with rebellion of Korah, led by Korah. Who were the other two? Dathan and Abiram. All right. Chapter 17. All right. Aaron's rod budded. Chapter 18. Support for the priesthood. 19. Purification from death. Why would that chapter be thrown in right here? We talked about this last time. Because so much death involved. Yes. In these 40 years, people are going to die. That's the whole point of them wondering for 40 years. Chapter 20, last time. Water from the rock and the death of Aaron. All right, what's chapter 21 about? Question number one. All right, here's the fiery serpents, and they're turning toward Pisgah. We'll talk about Pisgah in a minute, where that's located. And that's where we'll be at the end of that of this chapter in a moment. Chapter 22. Say again. All right. Balak makes a request to Balaam. And what's he want him to do? Curse Israel. So chapters 23 and 24, I group together, deal with prophecy of Balaam. Two are mentioned in chapter 22 are mentioned in chapter 23 and 24. All right. So here's what we have is the summary that you just gave to me, and that is the journey from Pisgah, or toward Pisgah, and the fiery serpents. That is one of those notable chapters. We all remember that story from childhood. Then chapter 22, Balak makes the request, and then we have Balaam's prophecy in chapters 23 and 24. So some notable things mentioned here that we need to get into and underway. All right, let's go to chapter 21 now. Chapter 21, I call it simply the journey toward Pisgah. That's where we're going to end up in a few moments. And then the most notable part of the chapter has to do with the fiery serpents. in verses 4 to 9, and then the rest of the chapter has to do with their journeying, and then some conquest of some land and conquering of kings on the east side of Jordan. That's significant because of where tribes will settle. That question hasn't come up yet, are settling on that side of the land, side of the river, but we'll get to that in a moment. Let's talk about victory over King of Arad. You may be reading from the King James, and it talks about King Arad. I think a better translation would be the American Standard, New King James of that, and I think the English Standard both all talk about the King of Arad. And we'll get to where that is in just a moment. In fact, right here we are. This is the Dead Sea. We're going to see the Dead Sea from different angles tonight because we're going to get north of there in just a few moments. We're over here at Kadesh and Mount Hor. This is where Aaron would have died. They're making their way, and they're going to have to make their way on up this direction, but why don't they just go straight across Edom? They wouldn't let them. They asked permission, and they said, no, well, we won't hinder anything. We'll pay, we'll, et cetera. We're going to stay on the main highway, on the public highway. No, they were not allowed. They would attack them. So they've got to go around. Now, we'll talk about going around and take a look at that in just a few moments. But they're making their way over. Now, here, you can't read because of the small print, but right there in the middle of my circle where the arrow is Arad. And when the battle is over here in just a moment with this king, we're going to have this is going to take place right here at Hormah. See in the middle of my circle right there. All right. Now, with that in mind, I want us to move on and talk about this victory over the king. As they're making their way over, this king seems to attack them from the rear, though that's not mentioned here because it seems that he may attack some of them, took some of them as prisoners. We take that to be maybe some of the weaker ones. But as they were making their way, he dwelt in the south, that is in the south of Canaan, and he came out and fought against them and took some of them prisoners. Now what happens at verse 2? Israel made a vow to God, if you let us have victory over them, and then deliver this people, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And so the Lord listened, according to verse 3, and they utterly destroyed the cities. So the name of the place was called Hormah. That's where we were just a minute ago, right here. So as they're making their way across over, this is where that battle takes place. So he comes and attacks them. They drive him back. I take it back up in that direction, and consequently, that's where the battle took place. So there's victory over the king of Arad. Now then, let's go further. At beginning at verse 4, they're going to make their way around the Red Sea. Now I'm going to get ahead of myself right here. This is, notice at verse 2, they are journeying from Mount Hor, where we were a moment ago, by way of the Red Sea to go around Edom. So they're going by way of the Red Sea. This is part of the Red Sea right here, where my dot is. And so they're going to make their way around Edom because Edom won't let them pass through. So they're going south. They're going away from where they are supposed to be going. Does that make sense? So consequently, verse 4 says they became very discouraged on the way. Your footnote will say they became very impatient. Well, they've been impatient all along. So became very discouraged. So what did they do? All right, they complained to God against Moses and said the same kinds of things. Now, this is toward the end of the 40 years, as we've already mentioned. And so for 40 years now, they've been complaining since they got in the wilderness. Better we'd been off in Egypt. And notice the kind of things they're saying now. There is no food and no water, and our souls loathe this worthless bread. The Lord had been providing for them. This is worthless, tasteless bread. This is something. And so the Lord's reaction was he sent fiery serpents. Now, there's a question as to what the fiery serpent refers to. Some think that it refers to the color of the serpent. Some scholars talk about that it was common for a serpent that was common for that time and period and place. to have some fiery spots or to have some red spots, as we may think of a copperhead having a copper color on its head, that there was a serpent or some serpents that were poisonous that had some red spots on them, whether that be the case or not. Others suggest that the idea of the fiery suggests what's going on is that when the serpent bites them with their poison or their venom, that it causes the swelling, inflammation, fever, and pain, and that was the fiery part of it. So here's the fiery bite or the fiery serpent, and others suggest maybe it's a combination of both, that it was a fiery-looking serpent that caused the fiery inflammation and fever and the pain, etc. Whatever the case, God sent fiery serpents. So what did the people do? Many of them died. And so the people came to Moses. Instead of complaining this time, they come and say, "We've sinned." They recognize they got a problem. And pray to God for us. And Moses prayed. Now, Moses is praying to God for the very people that complain against Moses. We see this time and again. That may be a commentary on the meekness of Moses that we've talked about already. Then at verse 8, what did the Lord say, tell Moses to do? Whoever looks at it shall live. And so verse 9, he did that. He put it on a pole, and if the serpent had bitten anyone, he looked on the bronze serpent, and he lived. Now let's make a few notes about that. There are a couple of references to that we need to flag for a moment. One is in John chapter 3, in verses 14 and 15, if you care to turn there, that there is a parallel drawn between the serpent being lifted up, and in verse 4, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so the Son of Man must be lifted up. Well, there's a number of parallels. The people committed sin, and God sent the serpents, and we sin, and there is death that comes, and there was a remedy needed. We need a remedy. And God had them lift up the serpent, and so our sacrifice is lifted up. Several parallels could be drawn with reference to that. Another thing that we might flag is 2 Kings 18 and in verse 4. By the time of Hezekiah destroyed this. They kept this serpent on a pole. And how do I know they kept it till the time of Hezekiah? They'd made an idol out of it, and they're bowing down and they're worshiping this, and so Hezekiah destroyed it. In his reforms, he comes in and destroys that. Well, it needs to be destroyed because they've made an idol out of it. God never intended for it to be an idol. Now, there's a parallel here to be drawn. For what it's worth, as you're talking to somebody about the conditions that have been laid down for salvation, for example, repentance or baptism, there's no power in the water, but that's simply an act of obedience. Is there any power in the snake or the serpent of brass? No. It's just an act of obedience. And if you looked, you would live. Make sense? There's another note to make with reference to that. Not everyone that was inside of the pole lived. Would you agree with that? Because not everybody would look. So just because they were inside of the pole and had access to the pole doesn't mean they're going to live. The text said they had to look to live. Does that mean they've earned their living? No. They're just meeting a condition of God. See the parallels? Very helpful tool right here in talking to your friend and to your neighbor. One writer observed that there's nothing said about relieving the pain or suffering, but that they live. If you're bitten by the serpent, you look, you'll live. Well, I've still got swelling. I've still got pain, but you're living. There may be consequences to our sins that we'll live with, but God will forgive you. But that doesn't mean the consequences won't be there. And to the world, doesn't that look foolish? You've been bitten by a fiery serpent. And Moses says, well, here's a serpent of brass. Just look at it and you'll be over your snake bite and you'll live. You're not going to die. Doesn't that sound foolish? That was the plan of God. There are a number of things in the plan of God that seem foolish to mankind. Does that make sense? Anything else on the fiery serpents? All right. Now, where did this, that's a good point. Where did this take place? The simple answer is we don't know for sure. but it's before they go around Edom. We know that much because we're about to track that. Many think that it took place right here at Punon. Now, why do we think that? Well, if you look at Numbers 33, just if you want to turn there, verses 42 and 43, I'm not going to turn there, but just after this battle with the king that we just talked about, of Arad, just after that, it mentions them coming to Punon and camping there. Well, and what Numbers 33 is, that's not after this event, that's recounting their travels is what it's doing in Numbers 33. So it's backing up and recounting their travels. And some have suggested, for example, Holman's, I might even have it right here, yes, Holman's Bible Atlas suggests that that's a possibility because of it was a site there known for its copper deposits. And so the bronze serpent episode would well fit there because of the bronze deposits. Does that mean we know that that's where that took place? No, it's just a possibility. We know they camped there, but is that where this took place? If that's not it, then we really don't know where that took place. All right, let's move on. We have some ground to cover. Now, what happens beginning at verse 10 through verse 20? They're going to journey from wherever they're camping at this episode, which may be Punon, going to make it all the way around Edom and Moab and on to Pisgah. All right. Now, what that means is we're about to travel, if our assumption be correct, and there is some conjecture there, they're going to travel all the way around Edom and make their way past Edom, past Moab, and on up here. And let's get Pisgah. This is the Dead Sea. This is the northern end of the Dead Sea. And here's Mount Pisgah. It was part of the Mount Nebo region and one of the higher peaks at Mount Nebo. Make sense? That's where we're going to end here in just a moment, this section. So let's back up and get some of the travels. We're just going to hit some high points. So they camped at Oboth. We see Oboth right here. They went to Oboth. Then we see them coming on to the valley of Jared. And I'm just trying to hit some of the high points. Look at verse 13. They come on the other side of Arnon. Arnon is a river. Now, you can't see Arnon. Abiram is also mentioned just before this. Arnon is right here. If you follow my little dot here, this is the river of Arnon. So it's mentioned several times. They camp beyond that. And so they've got that far. Now, let's stop and talk about the books of war or the book of wars that are mentioned at verse 14. It was said in the book of wars, and this seems to be a statement of celebration of victory as they're making their way around. There's a celebration of victory concerning the brooks of Arnon. That's that river we just crossed. And they reached to the dwelling of Ar and lies on the border of Moab. Now, what was the book of wars? Again, the simple answer is, I don't know for sure. It seems to be something written by an Israelite. It may have been an uninspired book that is being quoted. God sometimes would quote from uninspired books. For example, Titus quotes from the poets in the New Testament. Acts 17, there's a quotation from some of the poets. So it could be an uninspired record that maybe a Jew had written. Some have suggested it may be an inspired book. And not all inspired messages were canonized, meaning God never intended for them to be canonized. Canonized meaning this is the canon. This is the completed canon. So there were several things that God may have written or had inspired that wasn't canonized. God didn't intend on it. So what is that? I don't know. It's a record book that must have been reliable because Moses quotes from that. And that's about all I know to say that about that. Look at verse 16 now. They came to Beer, which means well, and that's close. I don't have it on the map, but that's right here close to Jahaz. So they've made it that far. And then they sang this song. By the way, the well suggests they've been getting water from a rock. And the well may suggest they're getting closer, and there's some conjecture here, getting closer to permanent dwelling into the land, getting that they're digging a well so that they're going to spend some time here before they cross over. And some are going to even stay on this side of the river. They don't know that yet, but some are going to stay on this side of the river. Make sense? So, verse 17 and 18 is just simply a song, again, a celebration. And then finally they make it to Pisgah, which is here. So they've made it all the way around the Dead Sea and come all the way around through Moab and Ammon, now they have made it to Mount Pisgah. And that's where we end that section before we have a couple of wars. Make sense? All right. Now let's get the victory over Sihon and Og. What do we know about Sihon? King of the Amorites. All right, so let's get a picture. This is kind of a crude map from Bible Manna, if some of you are familiar with that. But I want you to... Sihon is right here. We have the Moabites. We just passed through Edom and then the Moabites. All right, just north of the Moabites was the Amorites. And Sihon was king of the Amorites. Og was king of Bashan. And Bashan, down here is a little definition, was to the north and to the east and the northeast of the Sea of Galilee. Fertile land. All right? Now, let's get ahead of ourselves. When the tribes are finally settled in the land, this is the layout of where the tribes settle. So what we're talking about is this land where Reuben, Gad, and a half a tribe of Manasseh. This is what's being conquered here in this chapter. Does that make sense? So they conquer over Sihon and Og, not because God wants his people to have somebody else's land. This is, why does he drive out Og and Sihon? Repeatedly we made this point. Yeah, repeated references. We've come across some of those in Exodus because of the wickedness and it had become full and God's ready to deal with these people. So he's punishing Sihon and Og for their sin and then giving the land to his people. Does that make sense? So that's the land we're talking about now. So let's work through that. King of Sihon, they came to him and asked him, could we pass through? And his response was, no, can't do that. And so he came out and fought with them. And we don't have time to notice all the references here. He came to Jahaz, which is right here in the middle of that circle. Came to Jahaz and he fought against Israel. And Israel defeated him. And notice at verse 25 that Israel dwelt in all the cities in Heshbon. Heshbon is mentioned... All right, here's Jahaz, here's Heshbon right here. So they're working their way up. Now then, there's the celebration in song in verse 27, 28, and 29. I'm not going to read all of that. And then finally, Moses sent to spy out Jazer at verse 32. That's way up here at the top. We're making our way toward Og. Does that make sense? The king of Bashan. All right. So they basically drove out the Amorites in just a short little section here. They drove out the Amorites and they've occupied that land. Now there's a king to the north of that. And his name is Og and he's the king of Bashan. So let's see what happens here. At verse 33, they had a battle at Edrei. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that correct, but anyway, right here. So here's Heshem. And let's see, Jazer that we just mentioned, all the way the battle is even to the north. So we're up here close to the Sea of Galilee. And now they have conquered and defeated Og. Is that making sense? I know that's kind of a hurried look at that. I'm trying to get to the other prophecies concerning Balaam. So basically what we've just read is we've conquered this area where Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh are going to be occupying it later. So they've taken Sihon and Og, and those victories should give them some confidence when they cross over that they can fight and win the battles on the other side. Does that make sense? God's been with them. All right. Now then, that's what we saw in chapter 21. Let's go to 22. Let's get to Balak now and who Balak is in chapter 22. Balak makes a request to Balaam to curse Israel. So we got some ground to cover. Let's see if we can get this underway. Balak makes a request to Balaam. There's the first request, then there's the second request, and then we're going to see Balaam being rebuked. So let's get what's going on. First of all, at verse 2, let's get where they're camped. They are camped opposite in the plains of Moab, opposite of Jericho. All right, let's get our bearing. This is the Dead Sea, the northern end of the Dead Sea. Here's Jericho. Here's the Jordan River. So somewhere over here is where they're camped, opposite of Jericho. Now, when we get to the conquest, what's the first city they're going to take? Jericho, exactly. And so they're camping opposite of that. Now, let's talk about who Balak is. Who is Balak? King of Moab. They've just come through Moab. Come around Moab, rather. And king of Moab saw what they did to Sihon and Og. He's getting kind of nervous. And so he needs some help. And so who does he go to? Balaam. Who is Balaam? He's a prophet of God. Some would say he's not a prophet of God, but he was a prophet of God because God dealt with him. God spoke through him. So that means he was a prophet of God. We'll give evidence of that as we go along here. But where was he from? Prophet in Midian. Remember Midian? Midian's right down here. Here we are, right in the middle of the circle is the Dead Sea, and on up here is the Sea of Galilee, so that's kind of a small, reduced area. And down here is the land of Midian. That's where he was from. He was a prophet. There was something about him that made Balak know something of him, of what he could say and what he could do, and he was a prophet of God. And so he needs his help. Come on down here. Come on up here. I need your help. So I want to flag three verses here. And this has nothing to do with the flow of the story. It's just a response to our critics of the text who argue that the number is an inflated number. That is the number of the children of Israel, 600,000 men, fighting men, which we've calculated to be 1.2 to 2 million people. It's too many people, we're told. It's not a large number. Look at verse 3. The people are many. It's a large number. Sounds like a large number at verse 5. They cover the face of the earth. And verse 11 said they cover the face of the earth. It was an impressive view from Mount Pisgah to see what's going on here with the sea of people. Does that make sense? I'm just flagging three verses that tell us it was a very, very large number. All right. So let's get underway. What takes place here? What was his first request? Because the people were many, he sent ambassadors to go down and to Balak. And what do they take with them? Verse 7. A fee, a diviner's fee. Isn't that interesting? Peter calls that, refers to this very same thing, this very exact event. 2 Peter 2 and 15, he calls it the wages of unrighteousness. Was that the last time anybody's ever been paid, offered to be paid to tell it like they wanted it? No, that's happened time and again. That's called the wages of unrighteousness. So in other words, here's a fee. We'll pay you to say and do what we want you to do. I want you to go back to verse 6 with me. He said, I want you to come, and I know that whom you bless will be blessed, and whom you curse is cursed. This was a paganistic thought that man somehow can control God. And you're a prophet of God, and you're a prophet of the God of these people that is my threat. So if you bless them, they'll be blessed. If you curse them, they'll be cursed. So I want you to come and curse them. In other words, I think you can control that God of theirs. Well, that wasn't the case. So let's start down at verse 10. Then God came to Balaam, and what did he say to Balaam? Don't go. You shall not go with them. I'm at verse 12. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. Now, what did he tell the servants of Balak? All right. Notice the wording, though, at verse 12. Did he tell them the whole message? No, he didn't tell the whole message. What God said, let's go back to verse 12. You shall not go, you shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. And so Balaam rose in the morning and he said, "Go back," told Balak, "go back to your land, for the Lord refuses to give me permission to go with you." He didn't tell them they've been blessed, that God was going to bless. He didn't mention that. And so here is a man who is supposed to be a prophet of God, and does he speak the truth? He does speak the truth. We're going to see evidence of that. But he's interested in something. That money. He's interested in that money. And we're not going to get to it tonight, but he's going to finally do something to finally bring problems upon Israel, because he figured out how to do that. We'll save that for chapter 25. All right. Now notice at verse 19. He said, "Now therefore, please, you also stay here tonight that I may know more." I want to back up to verse 18. Balaam said, "If Balak were to give me a house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more." What a statement. Powerful statement. But here's what I want you to do. I want you to stay here, and then I will go and consult with the Lord, see if the Lord says anything else. What does that tell you? He's trying to find a way to wiggle around. God had already told him what he wanted. Don't go, I bless the people. He's trying to find a way to skirt around that. Now, yeah. Verse 20. Now, there's some questions. Commentators differ on this one, but follow me on this one, and I think verse 22 is our key to understanding verse 20 and 21. God said to him, "If the men come and call you, rise and go with them, but only the word I speak to you, that you shall do." All right, that's pretty simple. If they come and call for you, then you go with them, but only tell them what I told you to tell them. And so verse 21 said, "He arose and saddled his donkey and went." No indication they'd called. I think God's implying called again. And so you say, "Well, I'm not sure that's what that means." Well, at verse 22, my evidence of that is that God's anger was aroused because he went. Now, God had told him he could go, but if they call, they didn't call. He just took off anyway. He took that as permission. God's angry with him. So now what happens at verse 22 through 35? He takes off on this donkey. And God calls an angel standing in his path, and three times. So let's describe the first. The first time, the donkey saw the angel, goes off into the field. What does Balaam do? He struck him, beat his donkey there. And so the next time he sees the angel, what does he do? Crushes his leg against a rock wall. Beats him again. Third time he sees him, he lays down on him. If you've got an animal you ride and he lays down on you, that's about the last call, isn't it? And so he beats him again. And now what happens? Now, one of the strangest things to me is, there's got to be more to the story that's not told here, is that Balaam starts talking to this donkey. It's bad enough that a donkey starts talking to him, but he converses back as if this is normal. And what does he say to the donkey? "Yeah, I would have killed you because you have abused me these three times." And so the donkey said, "Am I not your donkey that I've ridden you since I became yours? And was I ever disposed to do that?" And he said, "No." And then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes and he saw the angel. Now, what happens at verse 32? Let's get that to verse 35 quickly, and I want us to get on to the prophecies. Angel rebukes him. Notice, and you might underline it, verse 32, that I did this because I came out to stand against you because your way is perverse. Now, that may imply that by your leaving, that's one, but I think God is implying, I know what your intent is. He's after money. He's after a way. He doesn't care about following God. He cares more about doing whatever he can to get a hold of that money, that house full of silver and gold, or whatever it is that he might get. And if this is interesting, at verse 33, if the donkey hadn't have done that, I might have killed you, the angel said. All right, now beginning at verse 36, finally Balaam and Balak meet. What happens here? Balak rebukes him, doesn't he? Like, I called for you and you hadn't come. And I sent messengers and I sent more messengers to you that were more honorable and you still didn't come. And Balaam responded saying, verse 38. Yeah, the words that God puts in my mouth, that's what I must speak. So, just a little note about where we are. Verse 39, Balaam went with Balak and they came to Kirjath Huzoth. All right, where is that? Right here in the middle of that circle. Just right below Jahaz. We've looked at Jahaz already. Just north of Moab. All right, now that's where we are. Now then, let's come to chapters 23 and 24. And this is starting at verse 41 of the previous chapter. We have four prophecies here. And we're going to summarize what each prophecy is. So we'll have time to get these prophecies. Now, I know we've got two chapters to go and we've got just a few minutes, but we need to try to get a summary of these prophecies. Notice what Balaam said. Tells Balak, I want you to build seven altars and I want you to offer seven bulls and seven rams. And you stay here, and then I'm going to go, at verse 3, I'm going to go and perhaps the Lord will come and meet me and show me what I will tell you. God's already told him what to tell him. So what's he doing? We might make a marginal note here to see chapter 24 and verse 1. If you haven't read ahead, what's he doing every time he tells Balak, you stay right here and I'm going to go off of yonder and I'll see what the Lord says. What's he doing? He's using sorcery, enchantments. And yet God still speaks to him, but he's looking for a different answer than God's giving. He wants to curse them so he can get the wages of unrighteousness. And so each time he's doing that. Now we're not told that at chapter 23, but in chapter 24 we are. So he comes back, but even though he's trying to do something else, let's summarize. What was the prophecy? What was the summary of prophecy number one? This gets us down through verse 12. Yes. All right, very good. Here's the summary of prophecy one. Look at verse 8. Verse 8, how can I curse whom God has cursed? Whom God has not cursed, and how can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? And so the basic answer or the summary of prophecy one, I cannot curse whom God has not cursed. You want me to curse him? I can't do that because God hadn't cursed him. And how can I, verse 12, speak what God has not put in my mouth? Starting at verse 13 through verse 26 is the second prophecy. What was the second prophecy? I want you to offer these animals here, and I'm going to go see what God's going to consult. God's already told him. So what's the second prophecy? Yes, look at verse 20. I'm at 23:20. Here's your verse that highlights that. I have received a command to bless, and he has blessed, and I cannot reverse it. So I can't curse what God hasn't cursed, prophecy number one. Prophecy number two, I have a command to bless, and I can't change it. I can't reverse it. All right, now, look at the end of verse 26. All that the Lord speaks, that I must do. Starting at verse 27 now, we have the third prophecy. What's the summary of the third prophecy? Verse 9 would be of chapter 24. Now, verse 24, verse 1, while you're thinking on that, here's that information I gave you a moment ago if you didn't catch this or haven't read ahead, that he did not go as at other times to use sorcery, but set his face toward the wilderness. And so he had been using sorcery. He's supposed to be a prophet of God, but he's not been following. But the Lord is making sure his message is protected. I won't have time to get to that in just a second. But what is verse 9, the summary of the prophecy? Yeah, that he blesses Israel, or Israel is blessed of God, is the point. Israel is blessed of God. So I can't curse, I've given a command to bless. Number two and number three basically is, blessed is he who blesses you, and cursed is he who curses you. This is a statement to Israel. So he blesses them. Balak had said, I want you to curse them. And he blesses them. Now let's flag verse 13. Verse 13 is a powerful verse. Balaam said to Balak, Did I not also send messengers to, saying this to you? Though Balak would give me a house full of silver and gold, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do good or evil of my own will. But what the Lord says, I must speak. Now, he may not be what he ought to be, but that's a correct statement. And that's a powerful statement to make. That would be the attitude of every one of us. Here's what the Lord said. I can't reverse it. I can't change it. If you give me the house full of silver and gold, I cannot do anything but speak what the Lord told me to speak. All right, now let's get to the fourth prophecy. It's different. And this starts at verse 15 and goes through verse 25. What's the fourth prophecy? It's different because it sounds like Isaiah, sounds like some of the Psalms. Sounds like it's messianic. And I take that it is. So let's see if we can make some sense of that. Look at verse 17. At verse 17, that I see him who is not now, I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel. Now that sounds a lot like some of the messianic prophecies of Isaiah, doesn't it? A star and a scepter. Now, I take it that I think it's those who interpret that as being messianic, a prophecy of the Messiah coming. In other words, this nation, Balak, that you want me to curse, God has blessed them. I can't curse them. God blesses them. And it's out of this nation is going to come the Messiah. Now, does Balaam understand that? Well, Peter says sometimes the prophets spoke of the Messiah when they didn't fully understand what they were talking about. They're just prophesying by God's inspiration. And does Balak understand? I doubt he understands a thing about that. But the point is, out of this nation that's being blessed, the Messiah is coming. And he's going to rule over the nations, three of which are mentioned here, one of which is, and batter the brow of Moab. In other words, I think it's kind of a twofold. Moab is ultimately going to be defeated. But he's going to be defeated through the Messiah, ultimately, if not soon. Does that make sense? All right. Now, I know that's kind of a short summary of each one of those prophecies, but I think we need to pay attention to this before we leave and our time's about done. That though Balaam, we're going to see, is a man who apostatizes, he's not what he ought to be. We're going to see more about that. He leads people into sin next week, chapter 25. Yet there was the divine protection of the message. God made sure the message came through clear. He was supposed to be a prophet of God. He was a prophet of God, but he apostatizes. He goes astray. But nonetheless, God protected. He said, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord. The word that God put in my mouth, I must speak. The Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth. The Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth. What the Lord says, I must speak, and I cannot speak of my own mind. Here's the divine protection of the message. Does that make sense? God got it out. God got it across. God takes care of his people. Make sense? We're going to have to stop.